Thank you for listening to this podcast brought to you by the Center for Christian Music Studies at Baylor University. This podcast was recorded at the 2012 Alleluia Conference. For more information about Alleluia, visit our website where you will find conference dates and details, audio and video recordings, and a list of confirmed clinicians for next summer's event. For this information and more, visit us online at www.baylor.edu/alleluia.
I teach at a small college out in central Kansas. Joe mentioned that last night. And it is a small college in central Kansas. We love the area, but we feel sometimes like we're in the center of the universe, which might not always be a great thing. But it's a fantastic place. I always call it Norman Rockwell America. It's a wonderful school and a wonderful community. We leave our, we don't, but folks out there leave their doors open at night and leave keys in the ignition. And I'm from Atlanta, and that's not how we do it in Atlanta. But we're kind of learning to fit into small town life out there, and we absolutely love it. I'm the professor, the piano professor there, but that's probably nowadays kind of the last thing that I do. I really spend most of my time, I do all the usual teaching things. I teach theory and, piano students and class piano and, music appreciate when it comes around and do some accompanying out there. But just about every free minute for me nowadays is taken up with arranging and composing for choirs and for piano, and so I'm excited to do that, and that's kind of a passion of mine, and glad to teach this class on it. So let's jump right in. The way that I'm going to teach this session, rather than kind of stand up here and spout out a lot of information like I did the last two sessions, I'm going to kind of let you guys teach, I guess, in some way. I'm going to you can see that what your handout that you have in front of you really is just a ton of questions, okay? My background is strictly piano, and it's odd because I spend most of my time nowadays writing. But I never had any composition classes or any arranging classes. When I was in school, I took the obligatory orchestration, which we all had to have. But that really, kind of told me about instrument ranges and, how to, write something for a bass, but it didn't really teach me any arranging skills or any composition skills. And, a lot of times theory won't necessarily do that either. So the way that I've taught myself how to arrange and how to write music is by really studying the music of others and analyzing their music. And in some ways, that really is the best teacher anyway. There's an old saying that everything about composition can be taught except how to write a great melody. And, there really is some truth to that, and it's not that it can't be taught, but I think that a lot of times it's self-teaching, and you kind of have to figure it out for yourself that makes the most effective learning. So your handout is a sheet that I developed a long time ago. I did not just develop this handout for the Alleluia Conference. It is a handout that I developed to help me analyze other people's arrangements. And I can't tell you how many arrangements I have analyzed from everyone, from Mark Hayes, from Joseph Martin, David Lance, Heather Sorensen, Larry Shackley, I've just Lloyd Larson. I've arranged everyone's, analyzed everyone's music. And I always have this sheet that you guys have there as your handout. And I go through, and you can see that I ask a zillion questions about the piece. I want to know everything about it. It's one thing to say, okay, this arrangement really is nice. I like it. I wish I'd written this. And it's then another thing to say, okay, well, why do I like it? Why is it so good? Or why is it maybe not so good? Because those kind of arrangements can be instructive too. And so I developed this sheet, and actually I also have a sheet for melody writing, believe it or not. And it's even longer. It's got like 24 questions to it. But I analyze every possible thing you can think of in a melody. What makes this melody work? I analyze Celtic tunes, show tunes, classical, everything. And when you really start to understand and know a piece on that level, then you start to kind of learn some things, and you can start to develop in some self-teaching, which can kind of help you with your writing. So, what I've done today with your handout, I've got that sheet, and I also have an arrangement of mine, of There Is a Fountain. Some of you, if you own the book by Shawnee Press called Simply Beautiful, got a blue cover, then you've seen this arrangement before. It comes from Simply Beautiful. This is There is a Fountain 2.0, because it's also coming out in an upcoming offertory piano solo book that I have coming out in a few months. And I love this. The upcoming book is a book of old hymns, and I love this hymn. It's one of my favorite ones, so I asked my editor, Joe, if he would let me insert it again. So we have 10 brand new arrangements in the upcoming book and this one repeat. So if you don't get anything else from today, at least you get a free offertory, you know, that you could play or you know, throw away or use it to start a fire when it's cold outside or, you know, whatever you want to do with it. But what I'm going to do is play this piece for you. And then we're going to talk through it. And along the way, as we talk through it, I'll introduce you to some common arranging concepts. And we'll talk through the piece and see how it works. I would have rather arranged, or not arranged, but analyzed someone else's music. But, you know, there's copyright issues when it comes to copying. I don't know if Mark Hayes would appreciate me making 40 copies of one of his, you know, anthems, so one of his piano arrangements, so I decided to just stick with one of mine. So, There is a Fountain. Let's listen to it. And then we're going to talk about it. It's been a while since I think I can probably get through this one from memory. I don't have to fiddle with page turns. Boy, what's up with crickets in Texas?
No longer a drought. They all came up.
Holy cow.
Thank you.
So, it's tough playing in front of a room full of pianists who have the music in front of them. You guys probably caught my little memory slip right there at the end of the first verse. But when you know the hymn, okay, you can kind of wing it. So, let's talk a couple of things through about this arrangement and see what you guys think about it. The song title, There Is a Fountain, obviously we know what that is. We know the arranger, that's me. And the genre, I write traditional kind of piano style with a hint of some jazz chords every now and then. Throughout a piece, I kind of have a little bit of a jazz background, and so throughout the piece I use some, you know, chords that use some extensions and things like that. We're going to talk through some of those things at a lead sheet session a little bit later on this week. The first thing that I like to analyze with an arrangement, and what I need for you guys to start doing if you're interested in learning to write arrangements, I like to analyze the formal structure of how people put the piece together, okay? We talked a little bit about form in one of the sessions yesterday, and form is, if you've ever been through musical, you know, music theory training, you know form is A-A-B-A, A-B-A, all that kind of stuff. Well, you can analyze arrangements a little bit the same way. Okay, let's talk through how I have this arrangement put together. Okay, what happens at the very beginning? What would you call that? Measure one. What would you call that?
Introduction.
It's introduction. Sure, that's right. It's introduction. How long does the introduction last?
Four measures.
Okay, so the first part of our form here that we want to talk about is, okay, measures one through four is introduction. Okay, tell me what happens next. Okay, the first verse is arranged. How long does that go?
Sixteen
measures. So when is it measure? So measure 5 through 20? Is that where what we kind of have for the first verse? Let me take a look at it here. Yeah, starts in, picks up into measure 5, and then it ends up in 20, and then we have the intro again, right, from 21 into, you know, about 24, so we have a little bit of a musical interlude, okay? Then we go into another verse, right? The next verse starts. How long does that last? This one's a little tricky. It's got a definite beginning, it doesn't have a very definite ending, right? It should end somewhere along about measure 39, but at that point, instead of ending it, it moves into another interlude, which moves us into a key change, right? And then at measure 43, we start the third verse, right? And how long does that last? All the way to about 58, that's right. Okay, and then what happens again? We have the introduction that comes back. That's right, we have the introduction. I picked this arrangement to play for you guys because it's, to me, a very clear-cut arrangement. It's not incredibly out there, and it illustrates a lot of standard kind of arranging procedures. This form that I've used, which is an introduction, and then maybe a verse, and then some kind of interlude, and in this case the interlude is going back to the introduction again, and then a verse, and then a modulation, and then a verse, and then bringing back the introduction again. That, I wish I had a penny for every piece that's arranged like that, both choral and piano. I mean, that's kind of a surefire winner, you know, to write a piece that way. And so that's a form that you can use, okay? It's a standard form that you can use, and arranging it, you know, another hymn, if you went out today and arranged To God Be the Glory or something like that and arranged it like this, you're not stealing from me because you copy my form. This is just one of the things that people do over and over and over and over and over ad nauseum. And there's other types of forms that you can do too. So when you start studying arrangements, you start to see how they're put together, kind of the building blocks of how they're put together, and that can help you when you start writing your arrangement. It's not formulaic, but in some ways, it's kind of formulaic. You know, I mean, because when you really look at things, there's a lot of pieces use the same structure in the same form. Let's look at number 5. does the arranger, which is me, hello, does the arranger employ any standard arranging devices? Okay, now, we want to talk through some of these devices. These devices might include an altered time signature, altered modality, or a change of style, okay? One of the first things that you can do, and I didn't do this here with this one, but one of the first things that you could do when you're writing an arrangement to create some interest, right? When you're looking for ideas, when you're looking for things to build an arrangement from, you know, okay, I want to arrange day by day or moment by moment some old hymn. It's been arranged 100 times. What can I do here that's different? Well, one of the first things that you can do is just change the time signature, right? Could I have done, you know, there is a fountain in another time signature? Probably. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two. I could have put it into three, right? I chose not to do that. I wanted to keep it in its more traditional 4-4, but one of the first resources you have as an arranger is to tinker around with altering the time signature, okay? It's a very, very cool thing to do. Altered modality. What do I mean by that? You know, and I didn't use that here, but taking a major tune and putting it in minor, you know, just about any hymn you can do that with, right? I mean, you can play Amazing Grace and play it in its traditional major key. I'm from the South, so I got to put a little Floyd Kramer in, you know. But you could minorize that, right? And, you know, that might be an effect that you could, you know, build your arrangement off of. And so it's always a cool idea to experiment with creating an entire arrangement, and if not an entire arrangement, at least a portion of an arrangement in an altered modality. What I really love doing and what I do a lot of is change of style. You know, and that's what a lot of arrangers do. Heather Sorensen is fantastic at it. You know, you take a piece that's written in a traditional style and you create something else with it. One of the tunes that I have coming out in this upcoming book is Lord, I Want to Be a Christian. You guys know that tune, Lord, I Want to Be a Christian in My Heart. Well, you know, it's usually done a cappella. It's usually done kind of as a spiritual, you know, and if it's arranged for piano, it's usually arranged introspective and kind of quiet. And it's a prayer, Lord, I want to be a Christian in my heart. Well, what I decided to do with my jazz interest was to create a more jazzy arrangement of it, which is kind of tacky. But, you know, it's just the way it goes. I have 3 degrees in music and I have no musical taste. But it's something like a... stride thing. So I love changing styles, and that a lot of times just right away you've got an arrangement there, you know, that's something a little bit different. So you want to experiment with that, and as you take these, you know, there I'm sure there's tons of extra sheets up there, as you take your arranging sheets and you start to now after this session analyze everyone's arrangements, then you can start to kind of get a feel for what works and how you write in certain styles. What about number 6? And here's a question I want you to answer. What chord progressions are used? Have the standard chord progressions been reharmonized? A lot of questions here in number 6. Are any progressions particularly unusual or beautiful? Are there any chord progressions that are typical of the style or genre? Now, you guys tell me, where are some places in here, and you know, I know it's been 10 minutes now since I played it, and you're not familiar with it, so your memory is going to start kind of going away on it. But were there any places that had any chord progressions that were a little bit unusual from the hymn as you know it?
Well, I circled 8.
8. Yeah. Okay.
I think that was your first little jazz thing.
Okay, in measure 8. Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Right? Where else? I know when you don't have it in your mind, it's kind of hard to remember, but
I thought on the second verse.
Mm-hmm. Of the second verse in 25?
Mm, well, 29.
29 is a big example of kind of tinkering around with chords. You know, what you usually have in a hymn is it's all on just a B flat chord. Right, and then it goes to an E flat. What we have here is, right, we have that sound. Probably my favorite, as the arranger, I can probably be allowed to have a favorite spot, but my favorite harmonization is probably reharmonization, is measure 51. Right, and I'm going to talk about how I came up with that, actually probably not in this session, but maybe in a lead sheet session. It goes by really quick, but it's this sound right here. Right, just that little descending chord progression in the bass. It's little things like that that really my ears pick up on and I really, really enjoy. Now, if you guys were analyzing a piece of music at home, and you had the sheet, you could sit and play it over and over, and assuming you've got some theory background, and most of us probably do, pianists maybe more so than other folks have theory, and all you have to do is have enough of a background to figure out what the chord is that you're playing. I mean, you don't have to, you know, be ready to, you know, do a Shankarian analysis on it or anything like that, just know what the chord is. And once you do that, then figure out the trick. You guys know that everything that you do, there's a trick to it, okay? I did something there called tritone substitution, and I'll tell you all about it when we do this lead sheet thing. The first one was, I think, a tritone sub, and then the second harmonization, the one that I said was my favorite at the top of page 50, all I did there was create chords based off of a descending bass line. If you look at the bass line there, it starts with an A, and then goes A flat, then G, F sharp, and then F. And I can tell you a little bit more about how I built that maybe a little bit later in the week, because the lead sheet tune that I'm using is actually There Is a Fountain. I thought it'd be nice to kind of tie all that in. So you guys see, you sit and you listen to Mark Hayes and you think, my gosh, how does Mark come up with all this stuff? Well, jump in there and find something you like and figure out what he's doing and copy it. You know, I mean, people use the same chord progressions and the same chord substitutions over and over and over and over, but you know, until you decide, well, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and just figure out what the trick is and then try to use it, you know, it's not going to happen for you. So, you know, I like to, when I analyze a piece, I look for every single chord substitution and the ones that I really like. I figure out what the chords are. I figure out what he's using these chords to substitute for. And then I try to find a hymn that, okay, where can I make this fit and experiment, you know. So it's a good thing to do. Now, the other thing that we're going to talk again a little bit more about it with a lead sheet session is that there are a lot of chords that are in this piece that I didn't tweak. I really didn't reharmonize. They're close to what you have in the hymn book, but I've added some notes to them, right? I've added some seconds and some ninths and some things like that. So keep that in the back of your mind, too, and we'll talk a little bit about that, how you can add notes to chords to kind of spice them up a little bit. Let's look at 7. What contrasts are found between various sections of the arrangement? Now, when I say contrasts, what I'm really talking about are keyboard figurations and textures. Are there any figurations or textures that are particularly beautiful to you? You know that when you create an arrangement, you have to have contrast, right? Otherwise, you know, it's going to get old pretty quick. Now, you can't have too much contrast, because if, you know, every 2 measures you're changing something, then that's too much information, and your listener is going to kind of say, okay, I can't process that. I know Mark Hayes. I've mentioned his name quite a bit. Mark is a good friend of mine. He lives in Kansas City. I live about 3 hours away, so I study with Mark. I have the opportunity of every couple of months I drive out to his place, and I don't remember the exact time, but I'm sure Mark probably worked with me on this one. And I remember Mark telling me one time that rather you're writing, and if you guys know Mark Hayes' work, you know that he's just particularly gifted with his keyboard writing. And I remember Mark saying that rather you're writing an accompaniment for a choral piece, or rather you're writing a solo offertory, about every 8 measures you want to start to change things up. And that was kind of his rule, to do just a little something different every 8 measures. And if you look at a lot of Mark's writing, he does that. I don't know how the guy comes up with all these different keyboard figurations that he does. But it's very creative, and about every 8 measures, that's what he does. So what kind of contrasts do we have in this piece? Can you guys explain it to me, what I did in these spots? What about measure 5? What would you call the texture?
I call it straightforward.
Yeah, it's just straightforward. The only thing that creates any interest in it is the addition of a few notes. That's right. You know, instead of going to just a straight B-flat chord, I stuck an A in there. Right, which kind of gives it a little bit more of that contemporary, a little bit of a fresh sound. But it's a single note right hand with really a very simple chord, click, chord, click, right? What's next? What happens next? That goes on for a little bit. It starts to change maybe around 13. The right hand gets a few more notes added, and the left hand goes into some simple arpeggios. Nothing too heavy. You don't want to, you know, give your big moment away at the beginning of the piece, because then you've got 50 measures after that that's kind of anticlimactic. And then we have this introduction back again. We'll talk about that in a minute. But then at 25, what's going on there? Can you explain it? Left-hand triplet pattern. Oh, that's it. That's a good thing, too. Okay, you mentioned that. The right hand is really the same thing. Okay, it's just single notes again. But the left hand has moved into triplets. And we've also had a register change. Okay, the left hand's moved up a little bit higher. That's good. Okay? And then the chord's sticking up a little bit around the tempo primo. And then we have this interlude. What happens in this interlude, which kind of starts, you know, around 39? What's going on there? We'll talk about melodically where that comes from in a minute, but I'm talking really about the texture of it. We have big chords in the right hand. What's the left hand doing? Yeah. Right. I mean, if you've played piano repertoire, I mean, you've only played that 1,000 times, you know, I mean, it's not earth-shattering. Then at the maestoso section, you know, this is where it you know, kind of finally gets big, and so it's very classical sounding, right? It's you know, kind of concerto-like, right? How is that created? Can you analyze that beyond just saying with your ear that's classical? What makes it classical?
Well, for one thing, it's at the golden mean.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be the high point.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
The entire keyboard
is used, right? Okay, so there we go back to a texture thing. I on the downbeats I play chords, so I've got a big thick right hand chord and then a left hand chord, and then I'm alternating that with a what we call a pedal point bass line. And now I'm seeing a lot of people nod. That's good. I mean, you guys understand theory. Whenever you have chords that change over a bass line that's staying the same, we call that a pedal point, okay? This is the pedal, and a lot of times, you know, it's used to create dramatic moments. You know, you can have, you know, that kind of a thing, you know, where they're, you know, you're building excitement. Well, I used a pedal point here. I have chords that are changing in the right hand, and I'm just coming back to G, G, G. And, you know, I mean, how many times has that been done? But it's very effective, right? And it's a trick that you can have in your bag of tricks, right, that you can pull out when you want to create that sound, okay? I need to pick this coffee up. Baylor's going to appreciate me spilling coffee all over the place. And then the big moment of the piece kind of continues down through the bottom and of the page and over to the top. And at the top of page 50, you keep the chords in the right hand, but the left hand finally has 16th note arpeggios, which is the busiest the left hand has been in the entire piece. Okay? And then it kind of finishes up a little bit. So, why do I go through all this? Because I want to catalog away in my mind as many piano textures as I can. And you could take any one of these textures and start to build an arrangement from it. It's not stealing from me. It's stealing from whoever I stole it from. And whoever that person stole it from, So, you know, I played Amazing Grace a minute ago. I'm not very good sometimes at doing things right on the spot, but you could take that triplet texture, right? You know, and all of a sudden you're starting to kind of get a little bit of an arrangement there, right? It's a figuration, it's a texture. So you could take any one of these things and go to your piano at home and just tinker around with it and say, okay, I'm going to, you know, do holy, holy, holy. I'm going to see if I can put a pedal point there. Or I'm going to do, you know, holy, 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 and let's see if I can, you know, create the triplet thing. Anything that I've done and anything that you find that appeals to you in any arrangement that you play, right? So catalog what people do and then try to replicate it. See, and I can't teach, no one can teach you guys how to do that. That's something that you just have to experiment with and figure out on your own. But you just have to recognize that's how it's done, right? That's how people learn. Okay, now, what about this? Does the arrangement text paint the lyrics in any way? What do I mean by text painting?
Well, the first part sounds like a fountain.
You got it. That's it. That's the trick. The first part sounds like a fountain. Okay, and that's probably the main spot in there where I do text paint the lyrics. Text painting is when you do something musically to show or highlight what's going on in the words, right? It can happen in instrumental music, it can happen in vocal music. I'm a country fan. Can you believe that? A classical guy that likes Mahler and writes choral anthems, loves Garth Brooks. But probably the most effective text painting that's ever happened is I got friends in low places, right? And low is the lowest note. Well, whoever wrote that tune, I mean, that was the money note. That's what sold that thing, right? And it made everyone rich. And that's a great example of text painting. And so the interlude and the introduction and the outro, the ending, which I won't play again because it's in your head because it happens three times, is text painting. From the very beginning, it sets up a feeling of, you know, kind of... water. I did an arrangement of Deep River in this book coming out, and I wanted to do the same thing there. I love those kind of textures. You guys know the spiritual Deep River. And so it starts out, right, then it, you know, eventually goes into it, and it has kind of has that contemporary feel to it. So text painting and finding ways musically to kind of do what's happening in the lyrics is always going to be a winner for you if you can figure out a way to do that. Number 9, does the arrangement modulate? What do I mean by modulate?
Change keys,
yeah. Most arrangements are going to modulate in some way. People do that to maintain interest, to create a sense of arrival, you know, at a big moment. Actually, the truth is, now this arrangement modulates, and I'm kind of a modulating guy. I love it. You know, I played one of my arrangements for a friend of mine later, and it went through about 4 or 5 different key changes, and he said, gosh, you ought to call this Around the Circle of Fifths with Brad Nix, because it just kind of modulate. I love it. But that trick is so overdone that a lot of times, sometimes just staying in one key, the whole piece can kind of actually be refreshing. You know, it's not done a lot. But if you do modulate, okay, do you guys realize that these modulations don't just happen? There's really only a couple of different ways you can modulate, and I have them listed there for you. Does the arranger use one of the standard modulating devices? These devices might include pivot chord modulation, chromatic inflection modulation, common tone modulation, or direct modulation. Now, what do I mean by each one of those? I'm going to go ahead and give you the answer here. I modulate by chromatic inflection, okay? I didn't come up with these. These are in arranging textbooks. These aren't fancy schmancy things that I developed. Everyone knows what this stuff means. If you have a pivot chord modulation, can anyone tell me what that is? Does anyone remember from theory what a pivot chord modulation might be? When you have...
One chord that's in common with all.
You got it. That's it. Every chord can be found, really every triad is not only found in one key, it usually can be found in a few other keys as well. Okay, so if I'm playing, something in the key of G, and I finish with a G chord, and I want to modulate somewhere, then I could use this G chord as a modulation into a new key. What other key that you guys can think of would have G in it?
C.
Yeah, C would, right? C would have that exactly. So, I'm playing something here. That's a little tricky because G is actually the 5 chord also in the key of C. So I might pick another chord. Let's get to C this way. I'm in the key of G, so here's G major. Now I'm in E minor. Right, well E minor is found in the key of C, so I can use this to modulate myself right in. And all of a sudden I'm in the key of C. Right, that's a C chord that I landed on. So, that's pivot chord modulation. Common tone modulation is one of my favorite types of modulation. It's beautiful. And by the way, these kind of things, guys, they're not limited to just piano writing. When you go and sing through all the anthems we're singing through, look and see how many times you find this stuff happening. It's all over the place, even with choral writing. Common tone modulation is when you find a note, right, that you could harmonize in one key, but you also can harmonize it in another. So what I mean by that is, let's finish up in the key of G again, whatever this little cadence is we're playing. Well, I'm playing a G here in the right hand. G is, the tonic in the key of G, but what other key is it also in? It's in E flat major, right? It's the third scale degree of E flat major, so why couldn't I go... Right? And then all of a sudden, just like that, I'm in the key of E-flat. Does that make sense? Chromatic inflection is probably the most common type of modulation. I mean, you guys know this sound, right? Amazing Grace. Okay, key change. And all of a sudden, we go up and do a new key. Well, what you're doing with chromatic inflection is... And this is getting into a little bit more theory than I want to go into with this, but basically the easiest way to change keys is to just somehow get to the dominant, right, if most of us know what dominant is, get to the 5 chord of the key that you want to go to, right? And that's actually what I do here, okay, but I just doctor it up a little bit. If you create a modulation like what I just gave you in Amazing Grace, where you're in one key and then all of a sudden let's go down to here, that's kind of plain. That's a little bit too congregational singing for me. That's how you modulate with congregational singing. But if you take a look at the key change, and if you go back to the score, I'll start at 39. I'm in the key of B flat. I just kind of doctored it up a little bit where it's not quite as vanilla, as just going straight to a 5. Does that make sense? You guys get what I'm saying there with that? So when you... Oh, direct modulation. Direct modulation is also another favorite of mine. It's where you move from one chord or one key into another key with no preparation at all. No preparation at all. Okay? So, if I'm sitting there and I'm playing something in the key of G, I'm trying to think of... modulation with no preparation for it. Those can sometimes be a little bit stark and sudden, but that's the effect sometimes you want to go. You want that effect to kind of make people, oh, wow, we're in a new key all of a sudden. So, analyze how people modulate. Figure it out, and then do your best to copy that. How's the introduction constructed? Does the arranger use one of the standard introduction devices? Okay, these are a lot of common sense things, but it's what people do. These devices might include an introduction drawn from thematic material, an introduction drawn from the accompaniment or freely composed introductions. Okay? This introduction, it's probably freely composed. What I mean by freely composed is it's the material you're playing in the introduction is not associated with the melody. You know, it's not associated with that. That's probably something that I overdo a lot. I love creating introductions that really don't have anything to do with the material. And that's sometimes probably maybe overdone with me. You can create an introduction that's drawn from thematic material, right? You can, in other words, a little, you know, if you're doing Amazing Grace, you ba-dee-da-da-dee, you know, and then all of a sudden you're into your theme. And then the other type of introduction that you sometimes can get is drawn from the accompaniment. The Deep River that I played for you guys a minute ago, that's text painting because I'm trying to create the sound of water, but at the same time, that's 16th note kind of fluid running pattern is something that is all in that arrangement the entire way through. And so it's an introduction that's drawn from the when I say the accompaniment, I mean kind of the texture, you know, of the piece. A little hint with your arranging or your composing, whatever it is that you embark on, you guys know that although the introduction is the first thing that you hear, just about everyone that I know writes the introduction last. It's the very last thing. Because when I start an arrangement, I really, it's like hopping into a car and I kind of know where I'm going, but I'm not really sure how I'm going to get there. You know, I'm going to try a lot of different routes to take me to that spot. And arranging is that same way. I don't approach it very intellectually. I probably should maybe more. I kind of have an idea of what I want to do, but I'm not exactly sure how everything is going to be and how it's going to fit and the form and until the arrangement is done. And a lot of times, as you're creating the arrangement, you'll discover some kind of counter melody that you come up with, or you'll discover some kind of accompaniment pattern, you know, that you have going on against your melody. And those often turn into really cool introductions. But when you're starting your arrangement, you haven't developed that yet. You know, so a lot of times, after I finish the arrangement, the introduction happens last. The other cool thing about that is if you, you know, have done the arrangement and you've created a couple of really cool textures or figurations that you'd like to make an introduction out of, then when you go back and make your introduction out of that, it kind of creates some unity, you know, for the piece because, you know, it's in the introduction, it's here, and you guys get what I'm saying. So write your introduction last. Okay, how is the ending constructed? As an arranger and a composer, I hate endings. I do. It's the hardest thing for me to write. I don't know why. Introductions usually are no trouble. The body of the arrangement is no trouble. I have trouble with endings. It's funny, I don't think he'd mind me saying this. I was talking to Joe Martin the other day, about 2 weeks ago, on the phone, and we were discussing one of my pieces that he was gracious enough to accept. And we were talking about the ending, and he even admitted that, you know, I hate endings. I struggle with how to create them. And so maybe you're not like me. Maybe your endings are no problem. But there's a couple of standard kind of stock things that you can experiment with when you're writing your ending, okay? Here they are. Repetition of the final phrase. Augmentation of the final phrase. Repetition of the introduction. Or freely composed ending. You know, I'm sure there are other types of endings that are out there, but once you start really analyzing what people do and trying to kind of figure out how to do this on your own, you're going to find that that's pretty much it. You know, the first one, the repetition of the final phrase, is probably something I don't do a lot because to me it's just done so much. You know, it's not very creative. How many times do you hear an artist, seems like we've been doing Amazing Grace here all day, but it's just everyone knows it. You know, you hear an artist, you know, finish up Amazing Grace, and they might do something like this. You know, and then they'll repeat it again, and finish it out. That's just done so much that, you know, I usually try to kind of find another, maybe a little bit more creative way to finish up the ending. Augmentation of the final phrase. When I say augmentation, I'm just elongating. You know, you could make that final phrase, you know, long. mix it up a little bit, but that's augmentation. I tend to like to either do freely composed endings, maybe something drawn from the material, or as I did in this one, I bring the introduction back. And I don't bring the introduction back because I can't figure out anything else to do. I like to bring it back because it bookends, you know, if it creates unity, you know, and rather people, you know, realize it when you're playing it or not. I'm convinced that at least on a subconscious level, people can recognize when there's unity, when there's a cohesiveness to the piece. That involves a lot of repetition. You know, we have to hear things over and over again in order for it to stick. It's just the way we are. And so one of the surefire ways of creating unity in an arrangement is to, you know, end it with the same material that you started with. So, you know, if you come up with a good introduction, that might make a really great ending, too. And that's what I did here. Number 12, we're finishing up here. What's the money note moment of the arrangement? You know, every piece has to have a moment. Even if it's a quiet piece, even quiet pieces have their moments. Every piece has to have a moment. I don't know if you guys have ever thought about this or not, but if we have any composers in here or songwriters, then you deal with this all the time. Most melodies have a shape to them, okay? And the standard shape is this. It starts here, and then somewhere along about halfway, it gets to its highest point, and then it tapers off to where it started. Okay? Even Amazing Grace is that way, right? If we think of this melody, where's the highest note? About halfway through, right? And then it hits it a couple more times, and then tapers back down to where it started, okay? Is that the only shape that's available? No. You know, if you guys know Bolero by Ravel, which is one of the most incredible pieces ever written, it has this shape, where it just continually gets louder and louder and louder right up to its end. You've got to, unless you're Ravel and you're kind of a master composer, it's kind of hard to sustain interest, you know, when it's just one long crescendo, but that's, you know, he's Ravel and I'm Brad Nick, so I'm not going to try to do that. Another, you know, there's all sorts of different shapes, but you want to be careful with how you plan your money note, your money moment. And it has to do with the shape. It usually comes in the big moment, the apex, you know, of the whole thing. Obviously, for this piece, the apex is there at the key change, you know, when it's really big, loud chords, okay? It's in a very obvious place. Again, this is a very straightforward arrangement. That's why I wanted to pick this. If I threw a lot of stuff out there that's really different and odd and off the wall, then, you know, that might be kind of hard to grasp some of these concepts. Where you place your money moment is important. If you place it somewhere here at the beginning, then all of a sudden you've got this, and then you've got five more minutes of arrangement, you're going to put people to sleep, right? It has to be paced well. And most of the time, that moment comes about halfway, maybe a little bit further than halfway, okay? The money note term I didn't come up with, that's a songwriter thing. They say that every song, you know, in Nashville, they say every song has a money note. With Friends in Low Places, it's the low, right? It's the note that's going to sell the song and make everyone rich, the money note. What contributes to the success of the money note moment here? We're actually going to get done with this here today. I love it. Well, you guys tell me. I mean, what I think that it at the Maestoso section, there's a couple of things that are working there that makes that a satisfying, loud moment in the piece. Tell me some of the things that happen.
Will you build up to it?
Sure. Okay. Here's, you know, when I went back and kind of analyzed my own piece, I think it's a combination of a key change. I think it's the dynamics. You know, that's an obvious thing, but that's the first time you have a fortissimo in the piece. I think it's the keyboard writing. You know, we've talked about the texture already, but there's one other thing that adds to it, and that's the tempo. It's all of a sudden slower, a Maestoso kind of tempo. And anytime you slow something down, it kind of creates a noble, royal feel to it, right? You can think of nobility and royalty, and those guys don't move fast. They sit and, you know, enjoy all of their accolades. So it's that, those kind, and there might even be a few others, but those are the things that kind of contribute to the success of the moment. See, that's why I put those questions in your sheet, because when you're analyzing, it's not enough to just say, this is the money note moment. I want you to figure out what contributes to that moment. Because if you can figure out, oh, okay, it's dynamics, it's tempo, it's keyboard texture, if you can list out all the things that make that moment so special, then you've got a better chance of replicating it in your arranging. Right? It's never enough to just say, I like this. You've got to go deeper than that and say, well, I like it, but why? Or I don't like it, why? Yes?
Does a key have anything to do, I'm just thinking about that, because C, I guess the key of C is kind of like a sharp sounding, you know, I know things, you'll play something in a different key and it gives you a different feeling or emotion, but maybe C is kind of stark.
You know, C is a very bright, I don't have perfect pitch, but C is a bright key for me. Now, there is a fountain, I think it's usually in B-flat, I think, in the hymn book. And so that worked out conveniently because I modulated into a brighter key. But you're exactly right. And one of the things that when you start arranging, you can experiment with playing things in different keys. And honest to goodness, all keys are not created equal. You know, D-flat and A-flat tend to be dark and warm and rich. And, you know, the rhythm section keys, the guitar keys like E and A and things like that tend to be a little bit brighter. And that's an excellent point. I didn't even think of that. But C is a bright key. So the key you choose to play things in matters. Let's look down. I'm going to skip 13 just for a minute. I'm going to go down to additional thoughts where, you know, I just have a spot where I can write anything in that I want to. The last thing I want to touch on with this arrangement is the interludes. Okay? You have to have interludes in a piece. It can't just all be, you know, melody, verse, because again, that gets into, you know, what you do as a congregation. You know, when you sing through verse one and then you go and do, even, you know, Al Travis, you know, that's why we have these wonderful organ interludes, you know, in between verses. It's an interlude, you know, just to kind of, you know, top off what's been and then set up what's coming. And so you need to have interludes in your piece. Now, I use the introduction as my first interlude, wherever the measures are. That's a typical thing that a lot of people do. It's a very straightforward thing. By the time I get ready to do my second interlude and modulate, well, I didn't want to bring the introduction back again. I mean, I'd used it as the introduction, and then I'd used it as the interlude, and I had some kind of idea I'd probably finish up with it. Because actually, despite my rule, I think I did come up with the introduction first with this one, but I usually don't. But I knew I couldn't use it again, so we had to come up with something else. So what I like to do with the interlude is create some kind of interlude that's drawn from thematic material, right? Well, look where the melody is of this thing. If you look at 36 going into 37, I'm just playing the melody. And what we want to do is have this thing finish up. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, no finish, but we don't. Instead of doing that, I take that little snippet of phrase, ya-da-dee, and I build my interlude off of that. Right? So it's an interlude that's got kind of a new melody, but yet it's not really a new melody. It's a melody that's drawn from there as a fountain. Right? So you've got... just on three notes of There Is a Fountain. You know, it's not rocket science. You know, when you start to tinker around with the stuff, you really can, you know, figure it out.
And I thought, first of all, I thought when I heard you play it, I thought, well, gosh, that left hand, what's that doing? I mean, because that's like something totally different. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of like we're rushing to the big climax.
That's exactly the moment. You know, it's been soft and sweet, and now we need to kick some energy in, you know. And it is a rushing to the climax. That's right. That's right. I initially had, when I wrote that interlude, I had arpeggios there. Right? But, you know, going back to the rule of, you know, let's not do too many things for too long. Since I had set up arpeggios in measure 37, I just felt like my ear needed to change. I wanted a texture change there, and I knew that I probably was going to use some arpeggios later in the piece, which I did. Now, the final question is kind of the summing up. It's what you get from the arrangement, and that's question 13. I mean, this is the most important question for me. It's what I learned from the arrangement that Brad Nix is going to try to copy in his next arrangement. Okay? You know, things, and again, I wrote the piece, so it's kind of hard to analyze your own arrangement, but just some of the things that I wrote down that you could learn from There Is a Fountain. The use of form in constructing an arrangement, we talked about that. This uses a very standard form, but it's one that you can use to great effect. The use of various piano textures to create contrasts as you move from one, you know, section of the arrangement to another. Chord substitutions. You might could find a chord substitution in there that you like that maybe you could copy. The use of pacing to create kind of a satisfying musical moment, you know, a big moment. If you just look at the arrangement from start to finish, you'll see that all the way from the beginning to the, you know, bottom of the next to last page and the top of the last page, there's more black ink as you go through it. It just gets busier and busier and busier. And that's a very standard thing. I mean, you just build up your energy and excitement and your busyness as you go through the arrangement. And there might be some other things, you know, that are in there that you could take away from it. Any questions? That's all I have. Do you guys have any questions for me at all? I had a lot of sheets up there, so take a blank sheet if you want one. And you don't have to, you can use my sheet as a spring, you know, maybe there's questions you would like to ask, you know. And I should have brought along my melody one because I have a whole melody sheet too. I'll see if I can. I have my laptop here, and it's on my laptop. So if I could send it to a printer here, I could print it off. So, yeah, absolutely. It's been very effective for me, this style of learning. Because so much of composition and arranging, you just really can't teach. But yet, it doesn't mean you can't learn how to do it. It's just something that a lot of times you have to figure out. And for me, that's learning that really sticks. It's deep learning. You know, I can read in a book what to do or, you know, Composition for Dummies and, okay, here's what you do. But, you know, when you really fight with it and wrestle with it and then figure out how to do it, then you've really learned something that you'll never forget, you know, when you fight with it. So, okay. Anything else, guys? Thanks for coming so early. It's so early in the morning. Oh, my gosh. It's early, early, early. Well, thank you so much. I'll see if I can get that sheet.
That would be fantastic.
I'll do a few more sessions this week. I've got a pain-free session, which is kind of a repeat of yesterday. And then for those of you that kind of want to delve a little bit more deeply into chord substitutions and kind of tones to put with things, I'm doing maybe, a lead sheet session. Yeah, that's it. And we'll take There Is a Fountain, actually. And I will just kind of, you know, go through it and add layer by layer until we, you know, kind of get a satisfying sound to it, so.
What is your musical extrovert thing? What's that about?
You know, it's, I teach, you know, primarily, and I deal with a lot of students that seem very shy at the piano. You know, there's some kind of pianists that are really, really shy and tentative and never really play above a piano, and there's some that are really just blah, you know, and they just kind of lay it all out there. Most of us, including me, are kind of in the middle, you know. And in dealing with some of these, my thought with this session was, okay, we have, you know, primarily church pianists that are here. You obviously do a lot of accompanying for your churches. If you ever play solos or offertories and you feel like, gosh, I'm not quite projecting what I want to project when I play all the time, then it's just techniques for helping you do that. So it's almost kind of a performance kind of a thing. So, anyway. All right. Have a great day, everyone.